Hello, folks. Hi, Sharad. How's it going, man?
It's going very well. And I'm going to say my usual line, which you can guess by now. I am excited.
Yes, you are excited. And me as well. Huh? And this is a very interesting episode, hopefully, of Long Shots. We have with us Mr. Manoj Kalra, Senior Vice President and Head of Group Business Services from Royal DSM. Manoj, it's a pleasure to have you. How are you?
I'm great, and how are you guys? Thank you so much for having me on this podcast.
The pleasure is all ours. And no, it's been every week is now a new week. I mean, there was a bit of things did quieten down from a macro / external narrative perspective from November, December onwards. But seems like nothing really has changed much in the last 1 year. What do you say to that?
I would say the same. Nothing has changed. There was a bit of relief within the country, but now it's back to square one. All I would say is stay safe, follow all the guidelines. Those who are eligible for getting vaccinated, try to get your shots in and keep yourself protected. That's what we're guiding everyone, and that's what I would also say.
You know, before we kind of started recording, you were kind of off the line talking about how people form such a central role for your work, on a day-to-day basis. And obviously, I think the best way to kind of start this conversation would be to just get a bit of an idea about, obviously, Royal DSM, your own professional journey. You obviously have been doing what you have been doing for over 2 decades now. You were almost, for a decade, you were in McKinsey. Prior to that, you were in Lehman Brothers. You've been in Reuters. So you're a very seasoned professional. And as, from your vantage point, would be good to first get a sense of, how group business services from a people perspective within your company, how it fits within the broad scheme of things, like a bit of an explainer for our audiences, and we can kind of take it from there.
So let me start from the beginning. By qualification, I'm a chartered accountant, so finance has been my domain, and I've really enjoyed working with numbers. But then in the late 90s, I work as a CA, and I started working for Indian Telephone Industries, known as ITI. I was, while I enjoyed my job, I felt that something is amiss here. And during that time, the field of ERP and shared services was evolving, working at scale, and kind of shifting from the traditional finance roles that we've all grown up with. While working in Crompton Greaves, I then came across a role in a company called Agilent Technologies, which was a spin-off of Hewlett Packard. And that's when I really hit my sweet spot. I think you mentioned people. Mm-hmm. I started enjoying working with larger teams. I started enjoying looking at how to break larger processes into smaller bits and being able to bring them and consolidate them in one central team. And I think as the industry evolved, I also evolved with it. So one led to the other. Moved from Agilent to Reuters, Reuters to Lehman Brothers, and sooner or later I found shared services in McKinsey. Mm-hmm. And that stint went off for around 11 and a half years, where not just finance, but then I started broadening my horizons way beyond finance. And while I wouldn't say it was planned, but I think two things helped me. One was understanding the support that businesses need to evolve. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't limit that to finance. Second is, how do you get people to move on and adapt to new ways of working? Because throughout these 20 years, technology has also evolved. What we used to do 20 years back, we don't do that the same. The concepts may be the same, but the way we approach it is very different. I did my articleship in CA. I remember writing ledgers with hands and cash. So as time moved on, I broadened my horizon. In DSM, I managed 6 centers around the world, put the businesses by providing HR, IT, finance, analytics, and procurement as a service. And we work with a large number of colleagues that actually come with these skill sets and try to provide cutting-edge support to the business so that they can focus on the top line while we manage the support. That's broadly my role, and that's how I see myself spending my day.
So on Royal DSM, like just a bit of additional input for the listeners, I mean, it's obviously a Dutch multinational company. It's described as a global science-based company with focus on nutrition, health, and sustainable living. Obviously, there's a wide suite of products, be it from nutritional side to pharmaceuticals to personal care, global operations, and obviously you're looking at the global support model for this organization across finance, procurement, IT, and analytics and HR. Yeah. And Manoj, like, when you look at global support models themselves, you know, I just want to kind of take a step back and look at the Indian market, you know, how it initially emerged as a quote-unquote cost arbitrage play. Over time, I think that moniker, for the right or wrong reason, has been now taken by other geographies, and India claims to, you know, have a more wider value addition into the entire mix. And that, with things like COVID and, you know, things like the, you know, stress of a pandemic, I'm sure it's a very evolving model on a day-to-day basis. And you probably had a good vantage point in terms of seeing it, how it has evolved from day one. So it would be, you know, great to kind of get your perspective on how global support within the Indian context has changed from what the popular perception or stereotype of it is to how it is actually panning out on ground.
You're right. If we take the evolution of support models, I would classify it in four stages. The first part, you're right, two decades back, throw some activities into a low-cost country and get them done. It had a focus of a CEO minus four or minus five level, and it was a department perhaps outsourcing or experiment. When the concept was proved, it then expanding where other departments, other functions felt, let's also do this in country. And that's when you started seeing, and the attention started going up to a CEO minus two, minus three level, where a CFO would take responsibility for such kind of activities. But at that time, it was still very much siloed to functional responsibilities. Then came the third stage where, wow, we've got all this work together. Why don't we consolidate it and build it into a group business services that provides service to a parent organization, where we can consolidate the skill sets across all support functions and bring in layers of automation, real estate optimization, HR practices, and start being able to think of improvements at a larger scale. And that's when the concept of group business services came in. And the fourth stage of evolution, which we're seeing now, is where we start creating ourselves into a value center where talent has no boundaries and products are being able to be, we are able to create such products which are or services which can come from these centers, or the talent that emerges into the future of the company products come from such kind of centers because of the way talent has evolved. And while you have the traditional organizations that have gone through these four stages, you also have unicorns that have actually set up state-of-the-art software development centers, technical centers in country, and today are most of their products are being developed. I mean, take Uber, for example. They have a huge center in Bangalore that was set up upfront and staged with the mindset of having it at stage four of the evolution, not from stage one. That's how this whole shift has happened over the last two decades.
Yeah. You know, another example was sort of Microsoft, right? I mean, when we talk about IT, a lot of typically with what started off as what you would describe as stage one, typical outsourcing of just writing code. And now I think Microsoft has the second biggest development center in Hyderabad, like after Seattle. So we've seen that evolution. But, you know, what started off with tech, and like, you know, you alluded to so many other practices that you're sort of involved in, from HR to analytics to, you know, other financial support. This adding of verticals, that's sort of a, you know, that's something that has not been there historically, and it's fast gaining traction. How deep do you think in terms of those cross-functional, you know, activities that can be thrown in? Because it's almost taking a holdco, subsidiaryco kind of a model. It's sort of evolving into that kind of a business, right? That you have an entity to run independently and just you sort of report to the parent organization. Is that sort of how the model is going to evolve into?
No, what would actually happen is what is happening right now is, yes, all verticals are establishing themselves. And here I'm going to broaden beyond India. We also take the opportunity of other countries so we can follow the sun and be closer to our customers. Mm-hmm. So that's why larger organizations will move from east to west in terms of having a footprint. But while these entities are being there, there's also a lot of focus on the fourth stage of evolution, how we add value. So either jobs that are repetitive or rule-based are getting automated or outsourced, because we have another market out there that is willing to do the work, repetitive jobs for you. Right. And you gives you the capacity and focus to evolve your organization to stage four. So that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. The second aspect that's happening is, in this model of GBS, your CXOs in the organization become your customers. You need to evolve with their strategy.
Sure.
If employee experience is strategy, you need to be able to bring out the best of finance, HR, IT, procurement to be able to give the employee the right level of experience. Because the life cycle of an employee touches all these aspects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From recruitment, from the first call of the recruiter, talent acquisition, to the final retirement of the individual. Every aspect. That's where a place like GBS cuts across all the verticals, creates a horizontal that gives these kind of experiences. Now, these are easier said than done because you have respective CXOs, you have respective goals, you have processes in place. But this is where the evolution is happening. How can we start giving experiences by combining the skill sets of these verticals? And whatever is rule-based, whatever is reputable in nature,
mm-hmm.
let somebody else do it perhaps. So, or automate it.
So is it like the classic, you know, definition of like back office, middle office, front office that you think is more of a dated concept now? I mean, it is much more interchangeable and fluid.
In the past, it was quite prominent.
Hmm.
Now it's more of, are you business facing or are you a business support?
Mm-hmm.
That's how it goes. The middle office stuff used to come more in a banking environment.
Yeah.
But in a manufacturing company, you wouldn't have the middle office. It'll be, you know, and you wouldn't say front and back. You would actually say business support and not. Are you a customer facing individual or not?
Right.
Because the skill sets for a customer facing versus not are very different.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And this is obviously an animal of globalization, right? Effectively. And over the last, I would say, 3 to 4 years, I mean, that was also kind of a consequence of, you know, like a Trump presidency in the US, that from globalization, all countries have now started also looking at things in a more inward looking, manner. So in that kind of changed geopolitical dynamic, what are the biggest challenges you see for like a GBS model going forward, like within the Indian context, you know, like getting good talent, stable regulatory environment? How do you kind of, you know, read those factors within the Indian context?
Yeah, I think the paradigm has changed over the last 12 months. Earlier, we were very city focused, footprint focused, and our ability to attract talent was, the city played a larger role in that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Today, as I'm talking, 1/3 of my staff have actually left Hyderabad. So I'm based out of Hyderabad,
okay.
And our office is in Hyderabad.
Yeah.
But 1/3 of our staff is working from their hometowns.
Hmm. Right.
I wouldn't say they're equally effective. I'd say they're far more effective.
Okay.
Interesting.
Right. Do we run into challenges? Of course we do. But we also used to run into challenges in the past environment. It's just that the nature of the beast has changed. So we had mitigations then. We are now working on new ways of mitigating the problems. But this also opens up my scope of attracting talent.
Right.
Yeah.
And at this moment, yes, the regulatory, the rules, you know, if you're in a SEZ zone, if you're in the SEZ or other things, there are rules that you have to follow. But in the current environment, we have those relaxations. And I think as the industry evolves, I'm sure our representation, you know, to the government will help us manage that. But that's a separate problem to solve. But coming back to talent, I think my ability to access talent has gone up tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
One, I don't need to convince a candidate to shift to Hyderabad.
Yeah.
Second, our way of working has changed from what can you do in 8-10 hours to tell me what can you do in a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of out-driven because you have the freedom to manage your day you want. And that also gives me a lot of access to diverse talent, which earlier was finding it difficult to commit to a 10-hour day and commute. Whereas now they can actually get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, work for 4 hours, focus on some other thing, get back to work in the evening, so on and so forth. So I think this has really opened up a new wave of accessing talent and being able to get things done in a very different manner. And we're learning. The last 12 months have really taught us a lot.
And do you think this model is here to stay? Or do you think there'll be some kind of reversion back to the old template of actually brick and mortar office going?
It'll be a shame if we go back to the old template,
yeah.
Which means work from home was by exception and work from office was the norm.
Yeah.
If that's the definition of the old template. I do see a hybrid way of working and that's a cause I'm cheering and working very closely on defining that,
mm-hmm.
where office will be a place where you innovate, ideate and collaborate.
Yeah.
You don't come to work.
Yeah.
We also have to be respectful for people who perhaps don't have the right level of work environment. And my metaphor here would be a library.
Mm-hmm.
When we used to go to college or when we were studying, sometimes we couldn't study at home. We would go to a library to study.
Right.
Similarly, you need to give an office to people who need to come and work because
sure.
the home environment provides that kind of conduciveness for them to work. So The future will be hybrid. The future will have people being onboarded virtually. If needed, perhaps fly to your headquarters, if I can call that. Mm-hmm. However, we should have a way of helping people work from home mm-hmm. and giving them the right level of infrastructure and tools. And also, we may have a satellite office framework that allows people to walk into their library to do some work. So my base is Hyderabad. If I have hired two people from Pune, how can I give them two or three workstations?
Right.
Or at least one workstation and go and access it
right.
as and when they need it, rather than trying to, you know, force themselves into one corner of the home and try to work.
Right. This is super fascinating, because obviously the newfound flexibility of managing your own time, that's a very prized asset. But that obviously has to be, you know, somehow balanced by the factor that it's the same thing like why kids go to school when they can learn online. I mean, there is a social dynamic which also is important, and that I think extrapolates within the office environment. So I do kind of understand, like, looking at a hybrid model going forward might be the right way. But like, if we like look at things as they stand in terms of, you know, let's just talk about like productivity or efficiency gains, is it also a question of the level of seniority or the kind of work that the person is doing, in the sense that obviously we operate in a much smaller paradigm than DSM, but what we often realize is that, the kind of process-oriented, structured tasks, they run more efficiently when people are at home. But when it comes to, you know, ideation, high-level thinking, then often, meeting someone in person has a better endpoint. Well, what's your experience been like in that regard?
There's a vibe you can't replicate. Having few people in a room versus having few people on a Zoom call or a Teams call, you can't replicate that. But the fact of the matter is, even in the past, not everyone used to be in the room. If you have a global team, you have a few people who are actually dialing in. You have people on in the room. And I would even say that a year back, in retrospect, I don't think we were trained well enough. We hadn't trained ourselves well enough to accommodate people online and offline.
Right.
Because the online people would always feel a little left out because of the vibe of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in today's world, with technology, and of course, you have to invest in the right level of technology. You have to have collaborative screens. You have to be able to write. You have to be able to talk. And the network has to carry that. But with the right level of technology, it's a lot easier and possible to do that. And through the training we've got over the last 1 year, I think we've been a lot more respectful for time. We know how to ask questions without barging into someone's conversation. Small tools in Teams or Zoom have come up where you can raise your hand and wait for your turn. Collaborative whiteboards have come out, which you can actually use and draw and ideate. And there's so much time you're saving on travel.
Yeah.
There is so much time. When I look back at my schedule, my travel was at least 60 to 70% of my time.
Right.
More than one third of the year I was staying in a hotel. Right. Where has all that time gone? I mean, for the last 1 year I've been working from home. So something was off. Something has changed now, which really gives us that access. It's also a mindset. Prior to COVID, we all believed that we have to be in a room and that's the only way to work. I think COVID pushed us to the wall and made us adapt new ways of working. And that's another thing. Second piece is the mindset, which has allowed us to adapt to that. And the third piece is a trust-based organization. I won't say seniority, but I would say if your culture invites trust and believes that, you know, we are working with the best intention, then I think things sort out for themselves. You may have problems in between. And of course, if they're trends, then you know how to deal with it. But otherwise, if your culture really invites trust, then that solves most of the problems.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some of these Western big tech names as well, right, who already had a little bit of a higher than normal work from home operational mandates. But now they've sort of, some of them have moved to like 100% or a hybrid, as you say, right? I mean, clearly those are, changes that are happening. Other than the whole remote working angle, what other changes have you seen from a COVID standpoint? Like, are there any, other things that you can flag on this front in terms of how this dynamic will change or evolve?
The adoption of technology is one big one.
Yeah,
I think it's brought us to a common platform on how we look at technology. The second piece is looking at HR practices. That has completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
now we're looking at ways of enabling and promoting working from home. We're looking at ways of how do you support wellness at home. Safety and security, which was to be of prime importance in the office, how do we bring that to home? How do we educate colleagues on how to stay safe at home?
Mm-hmm.
Usage how do you ideate, collaborate, and innovate? And how do you still continue doing what you're doing? So whether it's a transformational program, whether it's launching a new tool, bringing in and implementing a new software, how do we do that? So honestly, nothing has stopped. Some things have got amplified, some things have reduced, but nothing has stopped. And some roles are a lot more now in use, and some roles are not so much in use. For example, we don't have the kind of office space. I mean, we don't use our office the way we used to use it earlier. So the whole cabs and you know, managing the fleet of cars that would pick up employees and bring them, or the cafeteria in office, those kind of things have really reduced. So there's a shift, there's a paradigm shift in the way some of our day-to-day operations used to be managed.
You know, like you mentioned a very interesting point in the sense that some of the roles have become more prominent, more important, and some of them are kind of obviously have reduced in terms of focus area. Now, if we kind of, you know, decouple ourselves from the COVID narrative, there was anyways a kind of a growing narrative about the rising quote unquote threat of automation, within something like global, within something like group business services, right? I mean, there are lots of, I would say, process-oriented or repeat tasks, which over time are getting automated, right? I mean, we are seeing enterprise-level chatbots. We are seeing all sorts of things which are happening, you know. And in India, I mean, I know that the cost arbitrage narrative has probably, we have kind of moved beyond that. But cost arbitrage still is, it does have its own place, you know, when it comes to why these things exist in the first place. Do you kind of see that within our lifetime, like within like a decade or something, there will be a kind of a transition point where, you know, a lot of these things can be, a lot of these tasks can be done at a lower cost through a program or an enterprise platform versus a person. And that, considering the kind of, you know, skilling shortage or, you know, kind of a demographic dividend or demographic burden that India as a country has, is something we need to really face head on.
Correct. So let me take you 20 years back in time. When there was a secretary sitting outside a general manager's office typing a memo on a typewriter, on a manual typewriter. Then came the computer. And if I remember during that time, there were strikes happening in unions saying that computers will take away our jobs.
Yeah.
Fast forward, we then used to watch movies on a VCR, video cassette recorder, with VHS tapes. Fast forward, CDs came, compact disc, then DVDs, then movie streaming. On the support side, you had ERPs coming in, software coming in to do our work. You had Microsoft releasing Excel, Word, and all these kind of tools coming in. So change is the constant that's going to happen. Change is the only constant. And during all these changes, you and I kept on upskilling ourselves. And for those who refused to upskill themselves, found themselves redundant. As customers, you and I demand the best. We want Amazon to be one-touch delivery. We want our bank app to work seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
We want the best out of our mobile technology. Similar expectations are from our customers for the services that we provide. So the answer to your question, how will the future look like? I see a hell lot of automation happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is, at this moment, you and I are on the same platform when it comes to a skill level. If we choose to upskill ourselves with the advent of technology, we're good. If we choose to ignore that and turn a blind eye to that, there's a problem. So what we need to do as an organization, one of the HR practices which has also changed, is how do you enable your people to be skilled for the future? How can you bring in tools which allow people to access information and reskill themselves?
Right.
As you are automating, how can your people actually participate in that automation? Because the automation expert has also just learned this 6 months back.
Right.
He wasn't born as an automation expert 5 years back or 10 years back because
right.
this technology never existed.
Right.
It's just that he was intrigued and he got more into it. Likewise, people get intrigued and they want to learn more. So as organizations, we need to provide the platform for people to learn, just like we did 15 years back in teaching people Microsoft Excel.
You know, I mean, automation is kind of interesting, right? Because it has a complementary effect. There are often tools which make you more productive at what you do, but it also has a replacement risk in a few instances. I mean, we keep on hearing about how work might, how there might not be enough work for everyone in the future, right? I mean, only recently I was reading this book, The World with No Work by Daniel Susskind, I think. And there's a big argument about, universal basic income. And I know we are kind of going a bit segue from the initial outline of the conversation, but since we have the pleasure of having you, I wanted to just throw it out there, that there's that entire narrative around that, that there might not be sufficient work for everyone and the state might have to, come in and progressive taxation would have to be skewed so that the people who don't have work actually get some sort of money. Do you have that kind of frankly a bit cynical view of things? Or I have a feeling you're more optimistic. It sounds like that.
Yes, I am. Yeah. I am. Because again, if I go back to my narrative of 20 years back, while a computer replaced three people in office, it also created three more jobs to manage the computer in the back end.
Okay.
Where you have somebody who's manufacturing the computer, somebody who's managing the server, the data, and the network, and all that comes behind the infrastructure of that. People to design the bots for automation. You will need people to ideate with you. The nature of jobs are going to change. And at least till date, we haven't seen shortage of jobs. It's just that, are you skilled for those jobs?
Right.
And are you able to prepare yourself for that?
Yeah.
Well, this is a rather pleasant and optimistic note. I'm happy to hear that, because it's also a function of penetration, right? It's also a function of how many people are outside the footprint before you take a call, whether things are getting too crowded for people to get replaced or there'll be new jobs which is getting created. So from your perspective, it's a very kind of positive input that we are getting. It's been a pleasure to have you with us, Manoj. This was a lot of fun. What do you say, Sharad?
It was a great chat and got to hear your perspective, who deals with people and works and manages with a lot of people around. So it's good to hear your perspective in such a time where people are the ones who have been affected most.
Yeah, I agree. No, thank you so much. I think I really have fun with this conversation. You can actually see how much it is in the front of my mind as we are going through this pandemic and what does the future hold for. But hopefully all will be well. And the optimistic side of me saying that as we get through this, we will only evolve, come out stronger and be better than in what we do.
Perfect. Thank you.
Brilliant. With that, we'll be back soon, guys. Hopefully next week. I don't know. Next week. Let's figure that out offline.
Yeah.
And this was a great chat. Thanks a lot to Manoj. And this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.